Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening. As our children move to the very first Sunday in Godly Play, for them, they are going to be gathering together to learn about the grammar of grace. They're going to do that as a storyteller shares with them the first story of creation. That's what our youngest children are going to experience. And our older children upstairs are going to go a step further. And they're going to learn something that many people in our world aren't even aware of, and that's that the Bible starts with the first creation story and then goes right into a second one. And so they're going to wonder together about how God is moving through those stories. They're going to reflect on what that might mean for them. They'll see the story. They'll touch the story. They'll even gather for a feast at the end of that story. They are learning to pattern their life in a way of worship. They're learning to root their lives in grace. And as they begin to do that, it seems appropriate to open our worship together with this quote from David Orr. He wrote a book called Ecological Literacy, Educating Our Children for a Sustainable World. And this is what he says. The plain fact is that the planet does not need more successful people, but it does desperately need more peacemakers, healers, restorers, storytellers, and lovers of every kind. It needs people who live well in their places. It needs people of moral courage, willing to join the fight to make the world habitable and humane. And these qualities have little to do with success as we've defined it. See, dominant culture teaches our children and teaches us certain things about success. Success, on this view, hinges on being good enough, on achieving enough, on making more than enough. It's all about you and your individual capacity to achieve. And this kind of success is perpetually deferred. That's part of its destructiveness. See that reality of success is always just beyond reach, so there is always more to achieve and more to do, and one keeps leaning in that direction, hoping to touch something that is always beyond grasp. And that is precisely the opposite of what our Christian tradition teaches us and guides us in. I believe David Orr's understanding of what the planet desperately needs is what our children are wondering about as they gather together in Godly Play. I believe it's at the heart of our Christian tradition, shaping one another in lives as we become peacemakers, healers, restorers, storytellers, lovers of every kind, people who live well in their places. Our youngest children are reflecting together on that first story of creation, and our older children on the second story. And this morning, we are going to gather into focus with those youngest children on the very first story of creation, the 7 days, as we're told. And this feels very timely. It's timely on one obvious sense. We're sitting outside because our sanctuary has been under restoration, and we are thrilled, I am thrilled, to move back into it next Sunday. But it's also a time in which the global conversation has turned toward ecology and faith. The Pope, over the last few months, has released his own encyclical, and people across denominations and across religious lines are trying to reflect together on what it means to honor the earth and to follow in the ways of God. Just Friday, in the New York Times, there was an article about United Methodist new churches that are being planted in the United States around and commitments to environmental justice. And so one of those is a friend of mine and Linda's. His name is John Helmier. He's up at a church in Seattle called Valiant Mountain. And another is in Minneapolis. And it's a gift to be in relationship and partnership with pastors and communities of faith that are growing up with commitments to environmental sustainability and justice. All of those churches are without property early on. And so it's one thing to think about sustainability when you aren't actually blessed with the gift of a building. And it's another to try to imagine what sustainability looks like as you try to retrofit a building that was constructed decades and decades ago. John's Community in Seattle has recently purchased a property, and they've created what they call a collaboratory. Because so many churches are part of the lack of sustainability, not being used during the week. I think back 5 years ago when we gathered in this space and there were a couple of rooms that were used a couple of times a week. And then I remember on Thursday that one of our kitchen tables couldn't find a room on Thursday night because every single room in our space was being used by another group. So part of the sustainability question for churches like ours is to think, how do we actually use and live in to the space that we have? And then the gift comes of the hard questions. How do we retrofit in ways that allow us to be more sustainable as we move into the future? And to be sure, there are no simple or easy answers to these questions, but it is a gift to know that there are church planters in places as far as Minneapolis and New York City and Seattle that are beginning their own communities with a commitment to try to struggle with these issues. It's a gift to be part of a church, this one, that is interested in thinking about how do we live more fully in this place. After the first service, I had a farmer come up and talk with me that this is his daily work with children in elementary school. He's a farmer out in Carmichael and working with kids in this community. And so it's a blessing to be with folks who aren't just thinking about these things here on Sunday morning, but are trying to find ways to live this out in their everyday lives. We're going to turn to Genesis together this morning. And I want to point out something that struck me. I think I read this story, I don't even know how many times this week before I really realized something for the very first time. And I want to share this with you. Each time there is a day that is created in this first story, we just heard Christina read it. At every moment, at the end of that, you hear it in Genesis 1:10 and 12 and 18, this phrase. So think about in poetry or your own way that you reuse a phrase over and over for emphasis. This is the phrase that comes through in Genesis 1. And God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good. See, God doesn't announce at the end of the day, God was successful. That would have been a different approach, right? And God looked after the first day and God saw how successful God was. It doesn't say that. With the unfolding of each day, all we learn is that God saw that it was good. See, God doesn't make goodness contingent upon success. It doesn't say God separated the dark from the lightness and waited to see if it was going to be good enough. It just says God saw that it was good. Each and every time. But how often is it that we look on at what is or look within at ourselves and wonder, is it good enough? Is it enough? Successful enough? See, while dominant culture obsesses over success and enough, God looks on and simply sees goodness in all of creation, in you and me, in every human being and in all of the creatures around us, the stars above, the water that we long to see once again in the midst of a drought. God, in all of it, simply sees goodness. And I think as I hear it, it's almost as if God is surprised. God looks on at creation, looks on at what is, and simply sees goodness. There's a 14th century mystic. Her name is Julian of Norwich. And she writes about it this way. God's goodness fills all of God's creatures and all of God's blessed works full and endlessly overflows in them. God is everything which is good, as I see, and the goodness which everything has is God. This mystical thread runs throughout Christian traditions and invites us to think about all being in God. The fancy theological word for this is called panentheism. All is in God. And as we think together about climate and climate change, I think this is a helpful place for us to start, recognizing that we're not here for the very first time in the 21st century, but a 14th century mystic was seeing all in God, And then in the 18th century, John Wesley, the founder of what became the Methodist movement, as the folks who are being inspired by it in the United States to plant these environmental justice churches right now, he wrote this: God is in all things. And we're to see the Creator in the glass of every creature. He continues, we should use and look upon nothing as separate from God, which indeed is a kind of practical atheism. See, for him, to look on at anything and to not see God's presence in it, that's what actual atheism looks like. That's what it feels like, is not to be able to see or to feel the reverence in something else as you encounter it. And to be clear, this isn't saying that everything is God. This is far more subtle than that. The classic vision within the Christian tradition is that all is in God. It's radical incarnationalism. All is in God. Everything around us, all of it, is in God. And yet, at the same time, if you were to hold this story and keep reading, you might not think that we're called to an earth-honoring faith, but to an earth-rejecting faith. Because while all is in God, the story continues and it gets us into some trouble. At least we found trouble in the story. It says this: the first human beings are granted dominion, and then they're called to fill and subdue the earth. The Hebrew word doesn't help. You know, sometimes you go back to the original Hebrew and Greek, and sometimes it helps you. But the Hebrew word in this is actually kabosh. We are called to kabosh the earth. So, if we were to be really biblical in this, we would call our worship series not earth-honoring faith, but earth-kaboshing faith is how we would get to this space. At least that's how people have read it. But if you remember to the lines just before of God creating and seeing all of it as good, it's hard to imagine how there could be any warrant for such domination, such kaboshing at all. The call to kabosh the earth has become a password in our culture to legitimate overheating of the upper atmosphere. In the book of Genesis, they call that the heavens. It's been used to define and to perpetuate devastation of species to the point of not using, but using them up at a rate of whole populations, possibly dozens, going extinct every day. Could there actually be a greater mockery of Genesis 1? The rumor that dominion lets us do whatever we please to other earth creatures conveniently bolsters this economics that says we are to move toward unrestrained growth. And we reflected on this last week together. And it's not a coincidence then that some Christians have got caught up in kiboshing the earth. And so we see, as the Pope releases a statement, so too does the Southern Baptist Convention. Their statement, though, calls for an end to government mandated limits on anything related to carbon dioxide because of a fear for that restraining of growth. And so we have people reading out of both sides of how Genesis calls us to be, that all is in God and we are called to care for that, and also folks that are seeing in themselves a call to kabosh all that God has placed around them. Indeed, why is there this command to be fruitful and to multiply, to fill the earth and kabosh it? There's a prophetic theologian and Christian environmental activist. His name is John Cobb. And we were with John Cobb earlier this summer. He's 92. And John Cobb smiles when you ask him about this kaboshing of the earth. And the way he says it is this: yes, this is the only commandment in all of the Bible that we have actually managed to obey. We have followed up on this one. We picked one, and we stuck with it. And you know, you'll hear a response, or I can, an anti-environmentalist response that says, you know, only humans are very good. Everything else that's created is just good in Genesis. But humans are very good. And this is where it's helpful to actually turn back to the text. Because when you read it, that's not what's actually said. It says in Genesis 1:31, God saw everything that God had made, and indeed it was very good. Everything that God had made is what is very good. Not just humans as an ultimate of creation, but everything that was made, and we as humanity get to be part of that very goodness that God has created. A collective of species and of ways of being in the world. So it's no coincidence, at least it isn't to me, that we hear quoted ad nauseum calls to dominion and the command to be fruitful and multiply, kibosh the earth. But rarely do we hear, God saw everything that God made, and indeed it was very good. If you listen to the new Pope earlier this summer, you did hear a call. You heard an invitation to care for the earth in really profound and prophetic ways. In his encyclical on care for our common home, this is how it's talked about. Climate change is a global problem with grave implications: environmental, social, economic, political, and for the distribution of goods. It represents one of the principal challenges facing humanity in our day. Its worst impact will probably be felt in developing countries in the coming decades. Many of the poor live in areas particularly affected by phenomena related to warming. Their means of subsistence are dependent on natural reserves and ecosystems, services that, like agriculture, forestry, fishing. So there are no other financial activities or resources which can enable them to adapt to the climate change or to face natural disasters, and their access to services and protection is very, very limited. For example, changes in climate to which animals and plants cannot adapt lead them to migrate, but these poor folks are not able to migrate in the same ways, or when they do, they're displaced from the land on which they have lived and moved and had their being for so long. There is a tragic rise in the number of migrants seeking to flee from the growing poverty that's been caused by environmental degradation. They're not actually classified technically as refugees, so they have no international protections, and sadly, there's widespread indifference to this. And the Pope calls this our lack of response to this tragedy, our own inability to be responsible for our fellow brothers and sisters, which has been the bedrock of civil society, the bedrock upon which our society was founded. And so we have a lot of ways that we can respond as we try to figure out how to care for the earth. This morning, I want to invite us to reflect on a couple of those ways that we might talk about our own understanding of God to help guide us in these conversations. Not necessarily as a way that we're going to prove ourselves right and someone else wrong, but I want us to be able to talk from our own faith convictions and commitments as we talk about these issues. So Stephen Bouma Prediger, he writes a book called For the Beauty of the Earth. And he outlines a number of different ways that we as followers of Jesus might root ourselves in that tradition and also honor the earth. And I want to lift up a couple of different ones and to invite you to think about which of these might work for you. Which of these, and there doesn't have to just be one, but which of these might feel like a way that you can respond faithfully to the changes that are called for before us. One thread is what I would call the famous Shaker hymn says it best, "'Tis a gift to be simple." Yes? "'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free." In the words of Bill McKibben, the secret weapon of environmental change and social justice must be this: living with simple elegance is more pleasurable than living caught in the middle of our consumer culture. And so there's a way in which this becomes really practically lived out in our own faith lives, that we embrace or hold a reverence for simplicity that allows us to resist dominant ways of consumption. And to do that is to follow in the life of Jesus, the one who put relationships, community, the one who put before us the simple meal to remind us to be together. 'Tis a gift to be simple. A second way that we might think about this is that we should care for the earth because all creatures, according to our biblical tradition, are created for the glory of God and designed to sing God's praise. There's a contemporary theologian in the Reformed tradition, his name's Jürgen Moltmann, and he writes about this way. The creatures of the natural world are not there for the sake of human beings. Human beings are there for the sake of the glory of God, which the whole community of creation extols. So on this reasoning, we care for creation because we and all of creation are designed to give praise to God. And maybe that works for some of the ways you found yourself moving in relationship to Christian faith or wondering. A third one I think is much simpler. It simply says that God loves all creatures, so should we. We want to pattern our lives after the one that we call the divine. And God's love for those makes us then image bearers and calls us to do the exact same thing. God's concerns are our concerns. A final thread we'll call for the beauty of the earth. And on this view, we care for God's creatures because it's the appropriate response to God's care for us. God cares for you and for me. And then out of that, as image bearers, God, remember, all is in God, then we are called to care as well. All of these, to me, provide some ways of talking, at least in two places. And one of those places for me is in conversation with other followers of Jesus who would tell me that following in the ways of Jesus doesn't mean anything about how we spend or how we live and have our being. And there are certainly folks among us who fit into that category. And these also help me when I'm in conversation with the strongest of environmental activists who would say, I've witnessed the demise of the earth at the hands of Christian faith, so there can be nothing good within your tradition to say at all about honoring the earth. As I lived with these last couple of weeks, though, I've come to believe that Genesis has within it a way that invites us to hold these understandings, and then also to move beyond them. Each of these, for me, can really quickly get caught up in real practicalities and successes. But Genesis takes us back. It simply reminds us that God's ongoing creation with all that is, and all is in God, and God sees in that something very good. Full stop. God looks on at creation and sees something very good. See, if we can place our trust in this undomesticated God who looks on at creation and doesn't evaluate its success, but simply sees goodness, then I believe that we have an opportunity to place our trust and our hope not in our own technologies or our own intelligence or our own strength or our own work, but to find a much more dangerous faith that is rooted in a radical trust of a God who looks on at creation and sees goodness. So, for example, discussions of what is realistic when your trust and the center of what you're living out is in God take on a very different tone. The answer, of course, all depends on what's really real for you. But if God is really at the center of things, and God's good future is the most certain reality, then the truly realistic course of action is to buck this dominant consequentialist ethic of our age, which says that one should act only if one's actions will likely bring about good consequences. That's the dominant view that we tend to live with. And instead, to simply be people who embody a virtue of hope, and out of that hope, do all the good that we can. Emma is going to do all the good that she can to love on that baby. See, if we believe that God's at the center of things, co-creating with us, then we start to see everything around us as very good. And then we ought to recycle whether or not it's going to change the world. We ought to drive less and walk more whether or not it's going to change the world. Those of us who own homes ought to save and install solar panels whether or not it's going to change the world, but simply because God looks on at what is and sees something very good. If we believe that God's at the center of things and the church is God's body on earth, then we should lead the way in honoring the earth, not the government or private corporations. But we, as a community of faith, could lead the way. You see this right here, not good for solar panels. But you see that flat roof right above us? This whole facility in the coming decade could easily, if we make that commitment, be powered by renewable energy. We have the gift and the curse of trying to make a building from the 1950s work in 2015. And the truth is, when we look at pictures of people in the 1964 when they started to gather in this space, you think you're hot right now? They were in full three-piece suits sitting inside that space. August is blazing hot right now, and global warming has not changed it that much, people. Like, it was blazing hot back in their day as well. But the truth is, global warming has shifted it. And we know that farmers like Antonio are thinking about moving up to the foothills because they can see the writing on the wall. They can see that it's just going to keep getting hotter in valleys like this one. And so if we are to be the people of God and to embody that, why are we wait for government or for private corporations or for families to lead? What if we were to be a church that was right here on this visible street that was fully powered by sustainable resources? What if that was a gift that you wanted to leave to future generations? Just like the people that we don't know, who out of their deep generosity provided this space that I am so thankful that we're going to move back into next Sunday. What if someone in this very place, out of their generosity, allowed us to be a community that was looking toward the next 100 years in more sustainable and renewing ways? See, if we believe that God is at the center of things, then we should fulfill our calling to be caretakers for the earth. And the truth is, we should fulfill that regardless of whether global warming is real, regardless of whether there are holes in the ozone, regardless of whether 3 non-human species became extinct since you sat down in that chair. Our vocation as followers of the way is not contingent on results or even on the state of the planet. It's simply dependent on our character as God's human image-bearing, responsible community that sees within ourselves and with creation all around us something very good, that sees and hears God's truth, that all of it is very good. With that kind of faith and hope and love, may our lives be lived for the beauty of the earth. May we each be so moved by love and gratitude that we bear witness in small ways in our daily lives and big ways as a community to the great good news of a gospel that is filled with hope. And in so doing, may we live lives that proclaim hope, hope that lies within us, and hope that dwells in God's great good future. For all of this is very, very good. Thanks be to God. Amen. Yeah.